I'm Allison Love, and you're listening to Pod Clubhouse.
Pod Clubhouse.
Tom always had to drive. Whenever we went anywhere, on a trip, to a show, even to the grocery store, he never let me drive. And I tell you, I get into a car now, and I barely know what to do. I'm scared. And I used to love to drive. But now I just let Ace take me everywhere. And sometimes I think about that and I just get so mad. And I guess that's why I say things. I find that anger is more useful than grief.
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Welcome to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet, a Heels podcast. Tonight we're talking about episode 4 of Heels. This episode was called Cutting Promos. It was written by Daria Politan, and it was directed by Jessica Lowry, who also directed last week's episode. Hey, Caroline, how are you doing?
I'm great. I was so excited to get to this next episode because I wanted more information about King Tom and about Wild Bill. What was his deal with Willie? Like, I needed to know everything.
They really dangled the fruit, and that's not just a dick joke. I mean, and we got the whole backstory, right? We'd seen a little bit of the viral video via Rooster and Apocalypse's phones last episode with Wild Bill being naked with just a glowing belt on some kind of plane. This episode opens and we get Wild Bill saga begins to unfold and also introduces this concept that Willie just wasn't from that last generation with Wild Bill, but was sexually with Wild Bill.
And she made sure to make a point of that it was about the sex.
Let's listen to this right now.
Poor Wild Bill. You know what I would get for his money or his problems? I don't understand why you're ever with him.
You had sex with him.
Oh, God damn it, Willie.
You said you didn't understand. There's a lot of things a girl will overlook when the sex is great.
Just put that in the fucking poster.
Everyone knows that one already. But the people you love in your 20s, they get their hooks into you in a fucked up way. Things didn't end well with me and Bill. I don't know, maybe me letting him stay with us is a way to move past that. And, you know, with Bill down on his luck, he might be willing to promote us. He's got a hell of a lot more people paying attention to him for the first time in years.
I don't want him anywhere near me.
Now, there's two things going on in that clip. First is that true in your experience? Are women willing to overlook a lot of shitty behavior if the sex is good?
I think, yes, that is a well-known fact. I think a lot of men are willing to overlook a lot of shitty situations if the sex is good. Yeah, I think if that's working, there's a lot of other things that it can smooth over.
I think I definitely agree with you. I don't know.
Certainly when the sex is bad, it's very hard to make it up in other ways. So if you flip it, it's like, yeah, it's got to be true.
It's true. And bad sex usually tends to magnify other problems, too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the list of grievance becomes, you know, A is wrong and B is wrong and you fuck bad, you know.
And then there's that, too.
Willie makes, I think, a pretty valid point saying, use Wild Bill. The guy's got heat. He is a nationally seen figure now because he's been with the New York wrestling promotion. Let's say it's the WWE, like, stand-in. You know, but Jack just shuts it down without even considering it.
I think that it makes sense in other businesses to maybe want to stick away from like the wild guy or like the bad boy. But in this business where heels are just as marketable as the good guy, I feel like he's dismissing it too quickly.
I think this is Jack just showing that kind of hubris and ego that Charlie Gully is accused him of, that Wild Bill is accused him of. This is a flaw in Jack's character that people who also share that flaw, that vanity flaw, and the chip on their shoulder flaw, the Charlie Gullies and the Wild Bills of the world, are picking up on and highlighting to anyone who will listen to them. Whatever the baggage is, whether it's Wild Bill himself or the disloyalty that I think he seems to feel that Wild Bill showed towards his father and the Duffy Wrestling League, whatever it is, I think it's causing Jack to make a bad business decision here.
Hey, if Willie is willing to look past a bad ending of a relationship with him, even have him stay in her home, and is looking at it from a business standpoint and saying, like, this is someone who's getting a lot of eyes on him, we need to pay attention. She's got more in the game, as far as I'm concerned, than Jack does to be so quick to dismiss.
Let's talk about Willie, because this is the first episode where we actually get to see Willie's home life. I mean, when we talked to Mary McCormick a couple weeks ago, I had seen this episode at that point, and I remember talking to her about how it looks like Willie just lives at the dome, and we hinted at the fact that we're going to find out about Willie's home life. Up until this point, it kind of seems like maybe she's got a cot somewhere inside the dome that she only leaves to get whatever she's drinking out of her straw, like a refill for it. So were you surprised that she's with Ted and Robin? I mean, this is her family. Does that match Willie?
Seems like the story makes sense that she had a really wild time in her 20s. The pendulum swung hard the other direction, and she has like a much quieter side of her personality now that includes a beautiful home and a lovely piece of property and a very just sort of even keel lifestyle. I'm not going to say that it's like what everyone would want, but I think that it seems very safe, and it seems kind of like the antithesis of a Wild Bill, if you will.
Ted doesn't strike me in any way, shape, or form that he's ever going to get up on top of a motel and scream in the middle of the night or strip down to just wearing a glowing, blinking wrestling belt and nothing else on a plane.
Do you go with the guy who's exciting and going to keep you on your toes and the sex is great, but also, you know, there's a lot of negative things there? Or do you go with the guy who he's like a five, but he's always going to be a five, and you can count on him to pay the bills and be there for the kids and, you know, have a lovely home and stuff? Like, which way do you want to go? And it seems like Willie lived that first life pretty crazy and is now living more the second. Although I got to say, when she's at the dome, I feel like she dips her toe in, because we don't know what's in that drink, dips her toe into sort of the more, I'm still like a badass girl.
When she's out down by the lake with Wild Bill, you know, she's bumming smokes off of him. It makes me feel like she's not normally smoking around Ted and Robin when she's in the house. She's not drinking when she's around Ted and Robin in the house. He is definitely the vanilla choice for her, but she feels the pull and the urges to live that wild life. You know, Wild Bill is almost like a fox in the hen house a bit. And I gotta tell you, just based on how this episode was set up, I really fully expected them to have sex somewhere the end of the episode. I'm a little surprised that they actually went in the full other way, where Wild Bill gets unhinged. To call Ted Wiener Ted is one thing, and to call him a cuck bitch or whatever, because, you know, letting the guy stay in his house that used to bang his wife. But then he talks about Robin. The quote is, "Too bad I wasn't around to pay for that abortion." Holy fucking shit, Caroline. Could you imagine someone saying that to you?
No, that's horrible. That's a really terrible thing to say. At her core, Willie is a fisher person, right? I don't want to say fisherman, right? She's a fisher person. So knowing that about her, she has the patience and the quiet part of her personality that's willing to sit and be quiet and have that sort of safe and secure life, with these pops of excitement of like when you get a fish on the line and things are crazy and you're reeling it and it's wild. But you could sit there all afternoon waiting for that bite. And so I see how these two parts of her lifestyle like really matches her.
I think that's a really good analysis of her. One other thing I think we learned about her character, and I think it's important to mention only because I think it goes to the core badass that she is. If she isn't scared of these men, these testosterone filled men that surround her life other than Ted, the fact that she doesn't flinch. Like, right when he makes that abortion comment and she unloads on him and this is kind of smacking and punching him, he goes back and he like he's going to cock her in the face, but he stops his punch. She doesn't flinch. That says so much about her and her character and just what a fucking badass she is. Like, she really has no fear.
It also tells us that she's someone who's taken a punch before and that she has lived an abusive world before. So she was prepared. She wasn't scared because she's been on the other end of that before. And it might not be of Wild Bill's, it might have been, you know, her growing up life, I don't know, but she was fully expecting his response.
Well, and which is interesting, because it makes you wonder if this was a routine that her and Bill had gone through in their younger days.
Some old habits, huh? Some old patterns there.
She knows not to flinch, because you know, he's going to do what he's going to do. And, you know, he's going to.
You only flinch because you're not expecting it. Right. I mean, it's like a totally unconscious response. And so if you're expecting it, why would you flinch?
Let's stay on Wild Bill, though, because he has a couple of lines in this episode that really made me tilt my head. One is he's giving some advice to young Robin at the breakfast table. I liked Robin. I like that she was giving Bill shit, too. Like, it tells you, like, how just no one really respects this guy. He's just like a parasite. He says to her, don't be afraid of words or people. That struck me as oddly good advice. I mean, I don't think I ever want to get a quote of the day calendar from Wild Bill, not for inspirational quotes anyway.
Do you find it to be true that at the end of the day, you know, those situations or those entities that seem so intimidating, if you just break it down to they're only people, there's really nothing to be scared about talking to an individual person. I figured that out kind of earlier than I should have because of my kids being in the hospital and having to deal with doctors and people who typically intimidate people. I really quickly sort of gained some backbone in terms of being like, I don't have to listen to you. You're just a person. And I understand that you have expertise in this, but I have expertise in my kid. And having that sort of advocacy role, I think really changes how you feel about bigger entities and like not being afraid of the whole world because it's just a bunch of people, individual people.
Right. And most people are as afraid of you or as afraid as you of the world around them. You give people a lot of power when you show fear to them.
Mm-hmm. You come in not showing any fear, you've already knocked them back to two pegs.
If you can live a life where you're not afraid of people and you're not afraid of the words that they may say at you, you're already giving yourself kind of a protection to go through this world a little bit less hurt than others are going to go through it. I mean, but we have that lesson actually repeating here a couple of times. I'm sure we're going to talk about it, but you know, think back to Jack and his conversation with Ace when they're down in the basement looking at promo stuff. And he's telling Ace that, like, listen, you're a good heel, but you've got to learn how to be Ace the heel and character and Ace the person. Because right now you're blending it all together and you're fucking your shit up. Like, you have to learn how to build that wall and not let words and other people and what they think of you kind of affect you. That's advice that we all need.
That conversation was so fascinating to me, though, because I really felt like going back to our, you know, first episode and talking about how wrestlers have to be a certain way in the community and then how difficult it would be to separate that in your head of like, I am a good guy, even though I'm playing a bad guy, even though little kids are booing me, I'm still a good person and that type of thing. I can understand why this would be so complicated for Ace, who doesn't have a good sense of self. And I think that's where Willie wins the day in this episode for me, because she has a really strong sense of self.
Yeah.
So even though she's being generous and kind with Bill to allow him to be there and has some sense of responsibility even. So who knows, maybe it was on her advice that he go off to the big times or something. Who knows what role she played? Because there's something here where she feels some amount of responsibility for him. But she knows where to draw the line, right? Like, you can say just so much and then like, that's it. I know where I stand.
And just along the same lines, while Willie seems very much on board to publicly be aligned with Jack and his feelings about the DWL and where they can go and their potential, she never dunks on Wild Bill for leaving and going making it in the big time. She wasn't against Ace being recruited to go to New York. She agrees with Wild Bill. She agrees with Ace that these are good things for these individual humans, and in a way reflects well on Duffy, because at some point maybe they do come back. You know, Wild Bill is back in Duffy, Georgia. Maybe he doesn't want to be, and maybe he's not returning, you know, in the best of shape, but he's still back. And that's something that, you know, Jack has to change his perspective on, because he's going to look at it like Wild Bill is only back in town because he's got nowhere else to go. He's coming back with his tail between his legs, and, you know, he's a son of a bitch to boot. Jack needs to change that perspective and be like, hey, you're down on your luck. Now you can actually do something for this community and for this thing, this DWL that gave you a career for so many years.
You know, I think of the DWL in the same way as, especially you're a huge music lover. Do you know how there's like those specific clubs that would be so wonderful because they would be the ones that would have the bands right before they hit it big? It's like they managed to just cull through all the garbage and find those gems and would bring them to you as these concerts and stuff and be like, wow, these are the guys who are about to be amazing. Or they bring you guys who have like hit it big and now they're either kind of winding down or kind of having like the second career part where they're like hitting back to the clubs or whatever. Either way, they're my most favorite clubs because they're the places where you are about to learn the music that everybody else is going to die for. And I think if the DWL would just embrace that and feel like, what if people came from far and wide to be the ones who are just about to hit it big? Like, we're going to introduce them to the world. There's something to be said for that in terms of like, you can take a lot of pride in that being your role in the chain, you know, of where people go in wrestling. You don't have to be the gigantic stadium, but if you're the ones that are always discovering the next great thing, I mean, that's a really great person to be.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. It's there's a comedy club in New York called the Comedy Cellar. It's a total hole in the wall. Thinking about being there now in under a worldwide pandemic, the amount of times I've had people's like legs and arms in my lap that I didn't know because it's just so elbow to elbow there. But you go there, it's underneath like a Mediterranean restaurant, you know, and it's a cellar. It's a basement with a tiny stage. But you get to see like the best acts there, you know, famous comedians who run back there to work out new material, and guys and girls who are about to pop and become major stars elsewhere. Like, they're doing their thing here. They're like, mm-hmm. you know, this indie league, you know, to make the
they're
wrestling
kind of being
parallel.
Introduced, right? To the world. And then on the same token, like you were saying, I know you've mentioned to me before, like Seinfeld would like pop into something like yeah. that. And that's the Wild Bill though. That's the like, so you've been bigger than this place, but you come back and there's like these like kind of moments of like, ah, like, I can't believe I get to see him on this small, intimate stage. There's something really exciting about that. And DWL could really draw a crowd with that type of business model.
Well, here's the thing, right? And here's the hypocritical aspect to Jack's attitude in this whole thing. Last week, he has Ricky Rabies come to the DWL as a way to bring in tickets. Ricky Rabies is on the back end of his career. I mean, it's very clear. I mean, that's why he's so thankful, and I think sincerely so, to Jack. He says it at one point. He's leaving a room. He turns. He's like, you know, you're helping put like food on my family's table, and I can't thank you enough. Like, Ricky Rabies is not at the start of his career. He's on the back end. He's been doing it 20 plus years. So Jack doesn't have a problem bringing him in because he knows he's still going to draw a crowd and people are going to come, you know, pay their money to see this guy wrestle. Well, fuck, they're going to come see Wild Bill. I mean, Wild Bill, they're going to come see Wild Bill because he's Wild Bill, and that still means something in Duffy. Goddamn, the billboard is still up from his matches with King Tom Spade in town. But also, the motherfucker just showed his giant dick on a viral video. Like,
well, obviously, this is personal, though, right?
Exactly,
so just as, like, the whole reason, you know, everything that goes on with Willie and her family and Ted finally throwing him out and everything, the fact that he's even there, it's all personal. You know, it's not about business. It's about her, you know, wanting to try to help him get back on his feet and dry out a little bit and all that. So for Jack, it's personal. And we don't know yet the story of King Tom and Wild Bill. And what role did Willie play? I really want to know. I think she encouraged him to go. And I think that there's going to be a lot going on here, maybe about a betrayal between King Tom and Willie.
He says, kind of as a tossaway line, that Jack's the reason that Tom kills himself.
I know.
What the fuck does that mean?
I like wrote that down and wrote that down and wrote that down again because I was like, what could this mean? What does this mean? Why would Jack be the reason why he would kill himself?
Well, Willie gives a look and Wild Bill says, what, you think it's my fault? So it made me wonder, is that just Wild Bill bluster that he's going to put it on Jack versus himself? But what a specific comment to make about Jack. I mean, we heard Charlie Gulley say the DWL is going to fold ultimately because of Jack's ego. That is just a looking at a character flaw of Jack's and making a deduction about it. To say that this guy killed himself because of his son, that's a very specific kind of accusation to make. Really made me wonder what is going on with that statement.
It certainly implies some big actual moment in time. Yeah. Like that there's some pinpointed moment that everyone could either feel, you know, like that could spin it multiple ways to see like who was the bad guy in the story. Now, one of the obvious things is let Wild Bill go, Dad. I can be your headliner, and just not being able to step into those shoes. You know, there's something there, but that doesn't seem like enough to me.
My brain went to the same place when Willie gives him that look and he says, why, you think it's my fault? And then kind of intimating it's because he left, which maybe, you know, Tom, we're only as good as our partners in so many things. And when the attraction every single week is Tom versus, you know, King Tom Spade versus Wild Bill doing crazy shit together, and now one of them's gone, well, maybe that's the thing. Maybe it's not actually the deer. Maybe it's actually Wild Bill is the triggering mechanism that makes Tom feel like there's nothing left to live for. If it was an ultimatum kind of thing where Bill was getting recruited, maybe he wanted more money to stay, and Jack interceded and said, let that fucker go. You don't need him. I'll be your heel. And it'll be, you know, father versus son kind of thing. Something like that, that Jack encouraged his father to push Wild Bill out and or send him on his way that backfired. You know, maybe it was something like that.
That is how I'm leaning. And whether it's that Jack somehow couldn't, they focus so hard, like you said, about being a good partner. If maybe he just couldn't like fulfill those roles in the way that King Tom needed. I mean, it doesn't make sense, Mike. It doesn't make sense that you would kill yourself over that. I mean, it seems like, okay, I just need to grow my kid more. I don't know what. Maybe there's some sort of pitch to Jack that he goes as well, that he is going to get recruited in some way. And maybe that would just be like the straw for King Tom. I don't know. But there's something there with Jack, obviously, now that is like a whole new thing. And also really makes me squint my eye at him for pointing to Ace and saying, he knew you were home. Like, wow, everyone is passing the blame, huh? About who did what to the who and who was being mean to who.
Before we move off of Wild Bill, how sad was it watching him fight with that ice machine?
Oh my God. I was like, my heart like broke in half. That old man bending over stumble move he does.
With the glasses.
With the glasses on the tip of his nose and his hair all fuzzy and everything, I was like, oh, Bill, like you are a tiger with no teeth.
Yeah, just a gummy mouth motherfucker. You are 100%. It was so sad. It was so pathetic. I mean, I get why. And I kind of give Jack credit for not kicking him while he was down there. Because, man, what an easy shot for Jack to take if he was really bent on putting Wild Bill in the ground and out of the picture. It made me really sad. Wild Bill, bigger dick than you thought he would have. I mean, we talked about this. I mean, this is a show that's given us some, you know, it's given us lots of tits and ass. It's given us Wild Bill dick. I don't know that I was ready for that with that shot in the that full frontal shot.
I was not ready for that in the least, but I give them a lot of credit for staying balanced between the nudity between men and women. I give them a ton of credit for that because I don't care what anyone wants to see. Whether it's this person's, you know, full frontal or this person's, you know, tits or what, I don't really care. But they have done a more than typical job of trying to balance that, right? Like we've seen some man butts and we've seen some women butts. And now, I mean, full frontal peen is as max out as it gets, right? I mean, I don't know what else.
It's the greatest taboo there is. Now people,
I don't know where else we're going.
now people can be like, yeah, but it's like old man dick though. Like you're not showing us like, oh, you're not showing us Ace or Jack or, you know.
To those people, I would say, listen, we're only in episode 4. I mean, they can't show Jack and Ace now. You know, if they were ever going to show them, it's not going to be till like finale or something, right? And they're going to tease that biz for a long time. So hold on now. You got to start with some Wild Bill.
What? You got to work yourself up. And, you know,
like
to be fair,
Willie, you got to start with some Wild Bill.
I mean, not to mention the guy's got a fucking elephant trunk down there. So, I mean, girthy. girthy.
Hey, I want to talk about the belt that was right up above that girthy.
Ugh, that thing offended me. I was equally offended at that belt. What a chintzy, shitty little toy they made that thing.
That's what I thought. The word toy like came to mind so clearly, especially because I'm aware of how heavy the real belts are. And like if he was wearing it around and was like totally nude, it'd be like slipping down, you know, covering things up a little bit more. But it wasn't. So, you know, it was all plastic and fake. Yeah. And, you know,
super cheap,
lightweight. And right. I agree. I mean, it would be offensive to kind of, you know, dumb things down and make it seem so just cheap and plastic.
Here's the complexity of Wild Bill is I like when he stands up for the things that he's passionate about. I mean, he gives lots of bad advice and he makes lots of poor decisions, but I was happy that he stood up to the corporate stooges in that office and said, I've watched friends, you know, get killed for that belt. I've broken my ass and back and head, you know, sustained, you know, serious injuries for that belt. And you've made it this little chintzy toy.
You wouldn't do it to the Stanley Cup. You wouldn't do it to, you know,
or to
somebody.
A boxing or to a, yeah. to a boxing belt. I mean, like, right. you know, when Mike Tyson like or like, sports. You know, Muhammad Ali would never have a blinking belt when he was, right. you know, a boxing champion. Super disrespectful. I'm glad he said something when he said we should make it make some sounds too, like some beep boops. Yeah. And the guy was like, oh yeah, well, let's do that. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God.
I wanted to crawl on the motel roof and scream with him.
What is that a metaphor for? Is that him getting his mojo back, just the power of the clothes? Or was that just the toothless tiger roaring because he had nothing else to do?
I think it was some rock bottom shit. I think that, you know, when you saw how much stuff he had brought to Willie's, and they did a really good job of, yes. like, having Ted throw all that and realize, like, this is his entire life. Like, these are all his belongings. And to see them all shoved in that motel room and realize, like, oh, my God, like, this is the extent of your existence now. You could see where he wanted to break out. I mean, he literally got on the roof, went to the place where it would be the biggest, widest space he could get to kind of fight that, just like the world is closing in on you feeling. And I mean, I think it's rock bottom for me, but I also think that he still had, you know, a scream in his lungs to scream. So in that case, you know, I don't count him out in any form or fashion.
No, I think that's the thing with Wild Bill is you can't count him out, which is what I think Willie is picking up on when she's in the first clip that we played, the good sex clip. I think that's what she's picking up on. He's got heat. Like, he still has roars left in him. People will still come watch him despite your feelings. And so Jack's going to need to have to make it not personal and realize there's a business aspect here.
And it's a lot about volume with Wild Bill because, you know, again, we did the whole first episode talking about how you've got to stay in character and be a bad guy in town and all that kind of stuff too, right? If you make Wild Bill your heel and you can turn his volume down a little bit, a little more palatable, no frontal nudity on a plane, no, none of that, but he can still be a hustler. He can still be making snide remarks. He can still be doing that. Guess what? Then he's just playing his character very, very well. Not everybody gets to do that. It's within this wrestling structure that he gets to actually be a shitty guy and kind of like hide out in that persona.
I mean, that is a great segue to the other bit of advice that Wild Bill gets in this episode is when he's shooting pool with Ace. Ace is super fucking mopey in this episode and is mopey when he is with Bill shooting pool. And he gives him this advice about how he needs to redirect his anger into this new character. Let's listen to this clip. It's a little bit long, but it has a great finish, and that's why I'm playing it for as long as it goes.
One other trick.
To what?
Every day, 100 things happen to me, make me want to spit. Fucking people. All that bullshit, their untested manhood. Makes me want to step on a frog. Hear it crunch and ooze. No time for a final feeble ribbit. Regular folks, they gotta let that shit go. Puke out the black flies. But I use it. I soak it up. That's my superpower. Pay attention.
Hey! You mind telling me what happened to your 9-ball? I don't recall y'all sinking that one.
drugging, cheating, chicken dick snuck that ball in.
We didn't cheat. The ball must have rolled in on accident or something.
You call me a liar? Cheater? I bet your wife's a cheater too, you little cuck.
Talk about my wife.
Dude, these guys just kill her.
Hold on. You gonna seriously tell me you don't let someone else stick that fat ass wife of yours, you little fucking cuck bitch? Cuckle-doodle-doo, motherfucker.
I have been saying cuck-a-doodle-doo, motherfucker, for like 4 days.
Oh my god.
It's hysterical.
I bet you've been a delight to others.
I mean, yeah, my bosses certainly did not appreciate it. Not even a little bit.
Well, did it change your opinion of Bill that they hustled via cheating and that he just intimidated him by like yelling at him and stuff and he didn't outplay him?
No, I mean, I think that's pretty on brand for Bill. I mean, I think it's super enlightening about how Bill goes through his world. And I think the scene is important because even though we get to see shitty parts of Bill, right? The conversation he has with Willie and talking about the abortion and Robin and all that stuff, like really reveals the fact that he's not a good guy, even in his private life. But this scene, I think, demonstrates that Bill still knows, though, there is Bill and then there is Wild Bill, the character. And the fact that he can just manufacture this drama. I mean, that scene, and he goes, cuck-a-doodle-doo, motherfucker. But then he snaps the pool cue over his knee and, like, ready to go. And then he's like, I'm just fucking with you. And he kind of, like, laughs it off kind of thing. It seems a little unhinged, but it's actually really in control. That's a guy who knows exactly where his public persona goes to and what the limits of it are, because he can turn it on and turn it off. Well, he's not calling everyone cuck bitch all the time, only when he wants to. Does that make sense? Like, he's in control of the extreme persona.
I hesitate to use the word control because I don't think he has his finger on the volume knob quite as tightly as you're implying. I think that he sees the man's reaction and he backs off, but I don't know that he necessarily, like, if those other two guys started yelling back and didn't back down the way they did, I think it could have escalated. But the second he realized I won, I'm king of the mountain, then he backed off.
He went for the guy that he knew he was going to be get over, which is him showing he knows how to target. Remember, we were talking last week about heat, right? You walk into an arena and be like, your sports team suck and your mayor fucks pigs, whatever it is, right? To get that kind of heat kind of thing. Bill knows that. He knows. He looks at the crowd. This is something that Ace hasn't learned by when he was drunk at the karaoke bar, picking a fight with the tallest fucking dude playing pool instead of the short guy. What Bill knows, go for the tiny guy, because I'm going to get up in his face. I'm going to puff up my chest. I'm going to embarrass him and question his manhood. And I know that guy. I know it's going to work. He doesn't go after the big dude. He focuses it on the little dude.
Okay, so I'll give you control in that regard.
But I think that
if there was an unexpected response from the person, though, I think that he does not have the control to not let it escalate.
Oh, no, he would have used the pool stick and beat the shit out of the guy. He absolutely would. Like, his plan B is violence, for sure.
Yes.
But I think the demonstration there was this idea of turning his disgust for humanity and what he says, coughing up the black flies, and using it like a superpower. It's like literally every superhero villain story, like origin story, right? Where you would get so disgusted by some aspect of life or humanity that it makes you become this bad guy and rage against it kind of thing. And you draw your power from the bad energy of people. Right, that's the whole idea of Ghostbusters 2 with the bad right. slime, right?
Right, the bad ooze.
The bad ooze.
Be like, I smell some bad ooze up in here.
I mean, we know Bill has got very comfortable with bad ooze smells.
Yeah, I think he feeds off of bad ooze.
I am
frankly.
Sure he also emits and secretes ooze.
You know, he's got three letters that describe his ooze.
Here's the problem, though. I don't know that we want to be giving this advice to Ace. That was my worry about it, is I don't know Ace has the maturity to take the lesson that Bill is trying to impart here and turn it into something productive for Ace's standpoint. Ace's is at a point where he's still the guy who blindly gets drunk and picks raging fights with the people that he shouldn't be fighting with.
It goes back to that sense of self. It goes back to that it can't work for Ace because he's not comfortable in his own skin. So because of that, I mean, Wild Bill owns who he is. You know, he's a nasty guy and he knows it and he wears it like, you know, the big furry coat that he wears, right? But Ace is all over the place. He doesn't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy. He can't figure himself out. He's the guy with the blanket wrapped around his shoulders, you know? And that guy, he's too volatile. You can't try to impart a bunch of information. He's full of holes. You're just pouring into a colander, you know? It's just pouring all out and it's going to come out in the wrong way.
Wild Bill gives Ace another little tip here, and us, the audience, another little exposition moment here. We've seen this again with about Tom Spade. He mentions to Ace that Tom played nice for the crowds, but he says, but he had a vicious side, and he tells Ace, tap that vein. Ace is Tom Spade kind of incarnate, right? Was a good guy to the crowds, but was maybe a real son of a bitch behind closed doors. I think Bill sees so many of those Tom Spade traits inside of Ace.
Do you see it? Do you see those traits in Ace? Do you think that he is, like, I mean, we watched King Tom only just for a couple of minutes, really. But getting that guy's personality and getting how he would command a room and that type of thing, I mean, do you see those things in Ace?
I see the negative sides of it. You know, I think back to that Helen Cooper story about Ace telling the story, and it was his father's story that she'd go and eat the dog, and Ace just laughed at it. Like that apple in the tree, vicious nature that they would say those things about her. I see that thread. Ace doesn't seem like he's got the charisma that Tom did because he didn't know how to play the public persona good guy as well as Tom Spade seems to have. And maybe that's just experience, right? Because when the show first opens, Ace runs into the ring and the crowds are going crazy for him. It's only when he loses the match and then he cries that it all kind of goes south on him. So I think Ace is naturally a son of a bitch, has a vicious side, the same as Bill is saying his father did. I think Tom was better at putting on the good guy mask than Ace was better at maintaining that good guy mask. I think at their core, they're both not good guys, or at least have a really nasty, mean streak in them. Maybe when all is said and done and they're standing in front of St. Peter's, assuming they're burning in hell, and you look at the sum of their life, maybe they are good guys kind of thing.
Well, so here's the thing on that. I feel like it's the same trait that makes you a great leader can also make you a bully. It's like all about how you use that same skill set. And I think that everything I'm hearing you say and what I watch, Tom had the ability to be a leader. And also in his times of being more shitty and being more sarcastic or just kind of petty, he can let that those same observations that made him a good leader could turn into being a bully, you know, and saying shitty things, right? But I don't see the leadership skills in Ace in a way that's where I see when we mentioned last time, when you put the Ace and the Jack together, that's when you get Blackjack. I think Ace has some of the skills, but Jack's got the leadership part, but they have to play it together. They're two halves of Tom that have to come together in order to finally be bigger and better than what King Tom ever was.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense for sure. Yeah, I think, Ace definitely doesn't have the leadership quality yet, but that I think you have to discuss whether or not that's because Jack has not given him in the last year a chance, which is also a theme of this episode when him and his brother are talking. And actually, I want to play that clip as a starting point.
Do you have to be an asshole to be a heel?
Are you asking or are you calling me an asshole? No, you do not have to be an asshole to be a heel. You got to be able to take the heat if you're a heel, and you need to learn how to separate you the character from you the person. You cannot take this shit home with you. And when you're starting out, that is easier said than done.
I mean, that's the issue you've been talking about that you think you would have, and the issue that I think all these guys have, including like Big Jim, you know, that conversation on top of the water tower in the first episode.
I don't fault these guys for not having flexed their leadership muscles. They weren't allowed to. You know, there's one man in that room and it was King Tom, and it was nobody else could be a man. The rest were boys. I can't look at these guys and say, like, why are you not manning up? Why are you not acting more like mature and you know how to do it? Well, because they were like literally in like submissive roles all the days of their lives up until a year ago, where now all of a sudden they're supposed to know how to lead and run a business and be everything that Tom was in theory. So that's a weird double-edged sword, right? When you are a leader, you are the king, you still have to have, you know, succession line. And if you do such a good job of being the biggest, baddest guy in the room and everyone else learns to just be sort of the weaker ones, whoever can be strong enough to take over your reign.
I think back to these episodes that we've recorded, and I know I am really hard on Ace as a character, and I stand by it. I think I feel good about the criticisms. The one place where Ace has been wonderful, a truly wonderful human, and I've said it before, but it's really on display here, is the way he interacts with and treats and seemingly truly loves in a selfless kind of way Thomas, Jack and Stacy's kid. He is so good with him. And maybe it's because maturity level, they're about the same maturity level, but he's so good with Thomas. And this scene where he gives him his bulldog's blanket and he talks to him about how adults don't actually know everything, even though they may seem like it. But just the advice that, you know, nod to end a conversation. I wish someone had told me that when I was a little kid. I was a teenager. I was a pretty old teenager before I realized nodding ends a conversation as much as anything else does. What's your take on him and Thomas and that scene about whether or not Granddad is in fire and that whole scene?
I thought that old Mama Spade was laying it on unbelievably thick at the dinner table. And I really understand that she's going through some grief. And I applaud the conversation with Stacy to try to kind of reveal some of that grief and the layers and everything. However, I mean, come on, she's a grandma and she's not a new grandma. It's not like he's dating Stacy and this is like their third dinner together. Like, she's been a grandma for 8 years, you know, or 9 years, however old Tom is.
Well, they're married 9 years, we learn in this episode, and I think, yeah, Thomas is 8. So yeah,
every person has like the kind of side of them where they like turn on and turn off. I really agree with you what you're saying about Ace and his uncle role. Like, he's fantastic. I think though that comes from a camaraderie. Again, when you have a general in the house, all the soldiers have a way of kind of banding together and having their own kind of secret whispers in the bunks. That's how he was treating Thomas to me. Like, you just got yelled at by the general's wife, basically. You feel like shit. And so I'm going to come in here and kind of whisper with you how, you know, buddies do. But you're right. He has played a really consistent role of being a really great guy. I feel for Mama Spade, she has got a very twisted view. We've talked about suicide in the last episode. There are going to be a lot of really hard feelings about what that person did. And Mama Spade is very clearly laying this out here. What a huge obstacle for this family to try to get past. I really don't know. I'm so glad that Thomas has the support of Ace, because it doesn't look like anybody else is really going to be able to give him any like armor for this. My favorite line of that whole thing though was when Ace is saying that Mama Spade basically, you know, needs to read the Bible again, and Thomas said, should I tell her that? And he goes, no, you should not. Yeah, it's like that made me burst out. I was like, yes, that was like perfection. I loved that so much. But it was the warm and fuzzy and let you know that Ace is a good guy. He could have been gross, he could have been wormy. He could have just said, here's a blanket, and mumbled under his breath and kind of in that kind of teenage angsty kind of scooted out of the room. But he didn't. He was really cool. And he gave up his room to Thomas, which I thought was really nice, too.
It's when he's most likable. I mean, if he treated Crystal the way he treats Thomas, we would like Ace better. And we would like those two. We would root for those two as a couple. His world would be so much better if he had the same kind of compassion and empathy and patience that he shows with Thomas, with everyone else in his life. I feel like everyone would be a lot higher on Ace. I mean, there are a couple of things that came out of the conversation that were really interesting. And on top of him giving great advice to how to deal with adults and Mama, you know, Spade, Grandma Spade in particular, Thomas asks the question that all kids are going to ask when someone takes their life is why? And he says his spirit was broken. And Thomas's eyes like go wide and he asks the question, why, how your spirit can get broken? Like, what does that even mean? Like, how does your spirit get broken? I like that Ace doesn't just give an answer, because every other adult on every other TV show or movie would have come up with something. And he kind of shrugs and he's like, I don't know. I don't know how that happens, but it happened.
I appreciate anyone who could admit that they don't know something. I automatically have more respect for them, that they're not bullshitting me all the time. You know, the one little one-liner we got when Ace went downstairs to the basement and Jack says, thanks for, you know, letting Thomas have the bedroom. And he says, well, basements are scary. I loved that he still has that little part inside of him from the standpoint of understanding Thomas and wanting to protect Thomas from feeling scared. But it also continues to let us know how in touch he is with that little guy's side. Jack didn't walk down there feeling like the basement was scary. You know, like he was sprawled out on the couch watching TV. There's something that's good and bad about having that, you know, very close feeling with your child-like side, if you will.
Ace definitely seems to have some kind of arrested development aspects to him. Now, granted, he was basically the same age. He was an adult when his father took his life and he found him. But I think psychologically, damage-wise, it definitely puts you in a place where you emotionally maybe feel much younger. You know, it's such a vulnerable, scary, and painful thing to be the one to find him, kind of. Who knows what? I'm curious what Ace was like before that happened. Is he exactly the same? I find it doubtful he was exactly the same kind of person that he is now.
The only nugget we get is him coming out with that blanket wrapped around his shoulders.
Which he still wears.
Which he still wears. But it makes me, that's the only thing that makes me feel like I don't know any men with a ton of confidence and feeling like strong and badass and everything who would wear a blanket around like that. Like, I just don't know anyone like that. That to me signifies more of like a still of a meek personality, of a needing protection, needing to feel like they're covered up. There's something to that, that I feel like that's our only little nug that we have. But man, we have to mention his line at the very end. And that was a wild sex scene there with Trisha. But the conversation between them is where I want to focus in terms of just feeling like he has to have it together all the time and trying to handle everything and not really knowing how.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that his father's one mantra to him was you gotta keep it all together. That is a tough motto to live by when it's being drummed into you so regularly, where it becomes the only way of living is just keeping it together. The idea that you're not allowed to break down or have any other kind of emotion, any kind of vulnerability. You know, about the blanket and wearing it, it's interesting. He pulls that blanket out of the closet when he gives it to Thomas, which makes me wonder, like, is that not something he does anymore? Because maybe he associates that with his father killing his life, that maybe that blanket actually is a little bit soured now.
That makes sense. Yeah, absolutely.
Two more things came out of that conversation, which were interesting. One, just because it gives us exposition and it helps flesh out this family dynamic. Ace is the one who finds the body, but Ace tells Thomas that it's Jack who cleaned him up, though. I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I don't know what I would do if I found my father. Whatever happened after that scene that we saw in the flashback, it led to Jack being the one to clean him up and cart him away or somehow deal with it. Really interesting dynamic. Again, Jack being the one to come in, that general to come in, or the new general who's got like a promotion, like a battlefield promotion, to have to come in and kind of clean it up because Ace was with his mother.
It was messy. And I paused, like a little reality pause where I was like, what? Like, I know he said who cleaned him up. I didn't know if they really meant like cleaned up the backyard basically, or the stairs area, like after King Tom was gone or whatever. But I mean, in thinking what I would do, I mean, I would just, I would just, I mean, I would call 911 or scream for someone too, but then I would just stay with the person. I don't know that there'd be any like cleaning up portion. That part makes me actually feel like there's some sense of not dealing with it. Does that make sense? Like
I would just 100%.
Sit with the person versus like trying to clean it up, trying to put the pieces back together, if you will. That's not what I would think I would try to do, but I could see Jack trying to most literally try to put his dad back together.
Well, so I took that more like Ace didn't call 911. Ace called his brother and his brother coordinated 911. And stayed with his father while the coroners or the ambulance or whatever came and took the body away. Not that he was like folding him up in like a wheelbarrow or anything like that.
I wasn't saying, I don't mean it that far.
No, but I mean, I mean
like wiping the blood off his head or anything like that. Like, I don't know how far that comment went. It was a very generic comment that I was like, you could look at it. I mean, and that a lot of the comments that were going on in this, I want to talk about faith. That was one that was like used where you could like look at it in a lot of ways. That comment of like cleaning him up, there's a lot of ways to take it of like, yeah, Jack was the cleanup man after Tom. And there's just a lot there. You know, what's happened for the last year, Ace has stayed with his mom, you know, and Jack has continued to try to clean up. So I want to watch more. I'm really curious if we're going to have more flashbacks. I could really vividly see a Jack standing on those steps with like one of those with the hose with the sprayer on it, spraying the blood off of the stairs and stuff. Like, I can vividly see that in a way that's like, there's a lot of the story to tell. And by making it only a year ago, we don't even have to play around with like their ages and stuff, which I think is great because we don't have to have other actors or anything coming in or play like they're younger. Give them some side part or something, right? That's what they normally do to try to indicate now I'm younger or now I have bangs. So now I'm younger, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. Bangs. Or a mullet. Like, yes, that was the end of my mullet phase. Yeah.
Yes, none of that. I'm glad that we're close enough that they can just continue to show us some flashbacks and fill this in for us more, because how it happened, why it happened, this isn't one of those things that I feel like we can all just say, okay, we picked up directly after the car wreck. Let's move forward on how they're going to deal with it. Like, we need to know how the car wreck happened, because it's all wrapped up in Willie and Wild Bill and all of their stories have to be told in a flashbacky kind of way for me.
The fact that we now have seen him in the second episode makes me feel like we're gonna get more flashback, if nothing else, to maybe flesh out that comment that Wild Bill said to Willie that we were talking about before, about how Jack is responsible for King Tom Spade killing himself. Mm-hmm. There's something else happened a year ago or a little bit more than a year ago between Jack, Bill, and Tom that needs more fleshing out.
I think additionally, it's important to keep little snippets of Tom around because we need his presence to loom. And I don't want us to move forward with Jack and Ace in a way until they've processed this. I want his presence to continue to loom over this whole family and the DWL.
I want to pick up more on Mama Spade because you've brought up some good points in this episode. And much like last week's episode, I think this one also, and maybe this is going to be a theme for the show. Maybe this is going to be the theme for the show, is this idea of sadness and grief and how we process. And the fact that it's very clear now, Jack, Ace, and Carol, Mama Spade, are all grieving in their own ways, very much on their own timetables as they approach this year anniversary, which got brought up a couple of times. One, to set the table, Thomas and Ace are talking about how angry Mama Spade seemed, and Ace says correctly to Tom that sometimes sad comes out as mad. People, when they are sad or grieving, sometimes lash out like a viper with the worst kind of anger. But then you have this conversation between Ace and his mother when he's out drinking on the porch. That porch is so important to all of their lives. Think back to when Jack stood there and cried, and now Ace is out there drinking right by where his father would have fallen. Let's listen to this conversation here.
It's been almost a year.
I'm aware.
Can't sleep without music. When it's quiet, I hear the sound.
Ace, not every feeling deserves our extra attention. Sadness sometimes, it can be selfish. Sadness only thinks about itself.
Mama, that may sound real interesting to somebody who don't think about it. Maybe it's helpful, but sadness, it ain't like its own thing. You know, it's not like its own being with its own will. The sadness is there, so you listen to it. So you sort through it. That's why it's there. He stopped smiling way before Daddy did what he did to himself. Why? I think maybe if you took the time to answer that question yourself, you may be well on your way to being happy again.
I love when Ace comes out with these lines where he has such good advice for other people and doesn't seem to take any of it himself.
It was fair for Mama Spade to say not every single feeling deserves our attention. I think that was actually something that I took away from that conversation. You know, you can have waves of emotions and not every single one needs to be acted upon or dwelled on. But I really appreciate Ace's, you know, idea that sadness doesn't come alone, you know, that it comes with all these other emotions with it. And so you can't just like cherry pick which part you're feeling. You know, Mama Spade's not ready to deal with this. I really want to get into Mama Spade and this conversation with Stacey, because I think that the audio clip that you pulled for that, for me, is huge. And I really want to talk about that.
All right, let's play it right here.
Tom always had to drive. Whenever we went anywhere, on a trip, to a show, even to the grocery store, he never let me drive. And I tell you, I get into a car now, and I barely know what to do. I'm scared. And I used to love to drive. But now I just let Ace take me everywhere. And sometimes I think about that, and I just get so mad. And I guess that's why I say things. I find that anger is more useful than grief.
That is a huge revelation for her to have here. It mean everything we were saying about how, you know, King Tom took the air out of the room. No one could be a leader. No one could be a man when he's around. It sounds to me no one got to be anything when he was around. I mean, she wasn't even allowed to drive, and it created this atmosphere where I can see now Ace is scared to lead. Mama Spade is scared to drive. Like, they've actually been so submissive that they doubt their own abilities, and they're just fine with turning over their freedom, essentially, and their own growth, right? Yeah. To be able to do things. And this is big, because I think this sheds light not only on her, but on the whole family.
And it directly goes back to that conversation she's having with Ace, where Ace says to her, you stopped smiling well before, you know, Dad killed himself. And if you figure out why, you may actually begin to heal, maybe be able to feel happiness again. She had to check all of her agency, all of her kind of free will, in order to get along on the Tom Spade bus. That's going to lead to resentment and anger that you may not even realize, for a long time.
Well, and I think she didn't necessarily realize until he was no longer there to do the driving. And then she realized she couldn't pick up the keys and do it herself. So he not only robbed her of being the driver of the car, but he robbed her of the confidence to be able to drive the car now herself. But he left her alone to have to handle life by herself with zero confidence to be able to handle it.
There's been so many lines and concepts and feelings in this show so far that I have identified with in really personal ways. I'm not a wrestler, obviously, but in my life, I feel a lot of the things that these people are going through. This comment about this idea of, I used to love to drive and now I'm scared of it and it was robbed from me, I identified so heavily with the most. This was the most thing I've identified with in this show. And the thing she also doesn't say here, and people may sit and wonder and call bullshit on it, it's not something that happens in one felt swoop. It's something that is eroded from you. It is something taken from you a little bit at a time, over and over, the same way waves crashing on the beach slowly eat away at the sand and take it back out to sea with it. That's how you become afraid to drive. That's how you lose that love for driving, and now it's something you fear. A thing you loved is now something that you are dreadfully afraid of. that happens, and it happens slowly over time by the people that we allow to be closest to us because we let our guard down, and they fuck with it, and they can steal it, and they can rob it, and they can destroy it and poison it. I feel for her so much more. I like her for the first time in this series because I feel like I have an in to understanding why she is the way she is, why she's angry the way she is.
It's so much more complicated than what she appeared to be at first, being this like Bible thumping, it's just wrong to commit suicide. This feeling that you left me ill-equipped and you're the one that took it from me. I was a capable person in the first place, and now I feel like I can't do anything, and you're the one that put me in this position. I mean, I don't know how you have anything but anger. I mean, when you're as old as Mama Spade is and you're having to rebuild your confidence as who you are and what you're capable of, good Lord, I give her a ton of credit. I don't think that this is something that Ace is understanding, but his little nugget of, if you can figure out why you stopped smiling in the first place, I feel like it's going back to, like, think back to the time when you still drove. If you can get back to there and get that confidence back and find that mojo, then you can get through this. But man, what a double whammy to not only, you know, force you to play second fiddle, but then leave the show and now you got to play first fiddle. You're like, ah!
Right. You've ruined playing fiddle for me, and now I have to do the whole fucking thing by myself?
Because you left willingly.
Yeah, right. And so here's the thing. And when she's having this conversation with Stacy, you really get the impression this is the first time she's ever said it out loud, which mm-hmm. so often makes it real for the first time. That this is something, obviously, that's been in her head, but she maybe never allowed herself to think about and therefore admit to herself. So when saying it out loud to Stacy, I think makes it real, which then when you back up to the dinner and little Thomas finishes giving grace, and she turns to him and says, "Granddad is burning in hell for all eternity because he killed himself because he gave up." No, he's burning in hell in your head because he poisoned the well of your life, and you're angry. Rightfully, you're just misdirecting the anger. You're putting your anger at him on the wrong thing.
I'm going to even back it up even further. Do you remember when she's standing outside the church and she asks where Ace is when Jack and Stacy and Thomas are coming in? Now put it in perspective that Ace is the one that drives her around, which meant that morning she had to get a ride to church.
Yeah.
She wasn't just trying to be like, he's not just a mama's boy and she's not just trying to hold on to him. She is still in this space where she doesn't feel like she's capable of doing things. Like, this is much more complicated than how we first thought it was. She's trying to use Ace a little bit as like her crutch to get back to where she was.
The other aspect of Mama Spade in this episode that was so fascinating was the role that she played as kind of a Rosetta Stone for Stacy, who is having her own struggle trying to figure out how she can get along with this life in Duffy, Georgia, this life that she doesn't feel like she can escape and is not going in many ways any way like she thought it would go. And I want to talk about the supermarket scene where she's peppering Mama Spade with questions about whether or not she ever had a job or wanted to do something else besides sew clothes for the wrestlers and raise the boys. And just this idea of Stacy really kind of treating Mama Spade like an oracle. You know, she has that great conversation. She's like, we've been married. Jack and I have been married for 9 years, which was surprising to me, I guess. I don't know why. I mean, obviously, Thomas is of an age, so they've been married for a while. But hearing the number, it sounded...
Also smells a whole lot like Stacy was pregnant, and that's why they got married.
For sure. Which, you know, maybe also explains why Mama Spade treats Crystal the way she does, right? She's been through this song and dance of a Scarlet Woman coming into her life. But you know, so the supermarket conversation where Stacy finally gets the nerve to start asking some questions of Mama Spade, but then in the kitchen she says, like, we've never talked really, which is wild, you know. And Stacy's admitting kind of that this is crazy. I've been married to your son, I've been your daughter-in-law for 9 years, we've never really had any kind of significant conversation. And I like that Mama Spade, and I think it's real growth on her part, is able to open up. But I wanna ask you,
yes,
I mean, is Stacy listening to the conversation in the supermarket, you know, about how Mama Spade, I mean, she gives this great admission where she says, you know, I thought I'd be living somewhere else, but life doesn't work out like, you know, you think it is. And this idea that she had to devote her life to wrestling and to raising boys. Is she using Mama Spade like an oracle, but with the idea that she's going to go in the complete opposite direction, that she's terrified of what she learns?
Yeah, I think it's cautionary tale time.
That's the one.
I think it's 1,000% that, yeah, she sees that this is a woman who had, you know, everything out in front of her with a lot of ideas and a lot of things she wanted to do. I was angry, though, I have to tell you, I was mad at Mama Spade for using the line, basically the concept that you can't have a job if you're raising the kids right. Mm-hmm. I feel like that was a real shit thing to say. I understand that that's beyond old fashioned. I mean, when you think about all the things that women had to do prior to like washing machines and dishwashers and all that stuff, they were doing a hell of a lot more to run a household than simply raising the children. There was a lot more to do. We didn't have the conveniences. So additionally, I mean, most families require a second income. Like, this is just such a shit thing to put in the ether that I really hated that they had a woman say it to a younger woman. It's just such an ugly thing to say. Ignoring that for a moment, I think if you put together the two parts of like, I sewed the costumes and I raised the boys, and then put it together with the I didn't drive anymore and I got scared to drive and all that stuff. If you put those two things together, how do you not get Stacy saying, oh shit, if I don't want to be an angry and resentful person, I need to still have a life of my own outside of being, you know, a mother in this house. To be fair, she has an 8-year-old, one child household. That kiddo's heading off to school. She's got time to have a part-time job. I mean, I don't think it's out of reasonable realm that she didn't necessarily have her hands full. He seemed like a pretty easy kiddo.
He just wants to play soccer in the overgrown yard. I mean, he's just
really like, did. Yeah. And she had time to play the guitar and all that stuff. I'll tell you, there's a lot of moms who would be watching this episode who would be saying, shh, she had time to sit and strum on her guitar a while. Holy cow, I don't have time to do that. You know, I got a lot of stuff going on. So Stacy's life is different than Mama Spade. And that should be made clear. Mama Spade had a more difficult life. But Stacy wants more than Mama Spade was willing to settle for. And good on her. What do you think about her kind of having that moment with Jack where she says, I got the part-time job at the grocery store. And he says, it's the grocery store.
You know, it's beneath you, kind of. It was, you know, maybe it's the attitude that it was beneath you.
Yeah. And that maybe even, I'm just going to throw this out, maybe even cast some amount of negative light on Jack. Like, all the people are going to see you working, which means I'm not making enough money.
For sure.
And it's like the place where everybody in town is going to see you. So there's more pride business going on there.
Well, I mean, that begs the question. This is what my big takeaway was, is when he says, if you want to work, then I want you to. I just want you to be happy. He says that to her on the phone. Is that sincere? It is. I mean, that's what any partner should say to their partner, right? If you want to do this thing, then I want you to do this thing if it's going to make you feel happy. That's what any partner should say to their significant other. But
that saved the day very much for me.
But is it sincere, though? Because it's right on the heels of him making maybe this comment, maybe throwing shade at a supermarket.
I think that it's the right thing to say at the time, and he needs to get his feelings to that point, you know?
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think that, you know, he's still going to have that like,
It's like saying we're going to take a vacation, but now you actually have to go do it and take a fucking vacation.
He knows the right thing is to support his wife. Now he needs to actually support his wife. Those are two different things.
But what happens when Jack needs to go finish a script or needs to run down to the dome and Stacy's not around to take care of Thomas because she's got to pull a shift at the store? Jack gonna feel the same. Like, why? That's a rinky-dink job anyway. You know, you need to be supporting the DWL kind of thing. There's going to come a part where she's not going to be able to do something that Jack wants her to do because she's got to work.
Or someone's going to say something snarky because they saw Stacy at the grocery store. Yes. And he's going to have to actually face someone else on the outside where he's going to have to decide, is he going to support Stacy and say, no, this is what she wanted to do? Or is he going to be snarky about it, basically? We shall see. Let's see what kind of man Jack is.
Well, I mean, let's talking about the kind of man Jack has been, or at least father and husband and home care taker. Well, how about this fire? Have you ever had a fire in a house? I don't know that I would be able to sleep for a week if one, if I had a fire in my apartment, and two, it started in Tom's room. My son is also named Thomas, not just the Thomas in the show. It's just, you know, if the fire, I don't know that I'd be able to sleep. The guilt I would have over wiring being the source, you know, that was maybe caused by the squirrel that I was too busy to take care of.
Yeah, a known repair issue is like, oh, that's nightmarish for sure. And of course, I mean, happening in the kids' room, all the things are horrible. And Stacy seems like she has such a good head on her shoulders in terms of being proactive, and even somebody who would like have the maintenance schedule in her head, like, oh, you know, we need to, like, you know, whatever, clean out the air ducts, or we need to do whatever. Like, she actually seems like very good at running a household as opposed to just dealing with repairs. I give her some credit for not just chopping his block when they got out to the yard, because there would be a big part of me that would have more than just words in that situation, especially over the safety of our kid.
And the fact that he kind of tries to just band-aid over it, well, let's go to a hotel. You know, she's like, no, we got to take our medicine. We have to go stay with your fucking mother now because
of
this.
Well, we don't have money because I don't have a job.
Right. And insurance isn't going to pay for the whole thing. Right. And we're not just going to fix the room. We got to rewire the whole fucking house. It's the room. It's not like Thomas's room was wired differently than the rest of the house. It's just right where it happened here. So, you know, she has the better picture of what's going on in the household much better. It did occur to me, though, the idea of Jack having to put a fire out in his kid's room maybe serves as some kind of wake-up call that his negligence at home is literally putting his family in harm's way. Does that maybe affect the fact that he does open up to let Ace have a hand in writing and creating the promo that we see in this episode, that he doesn't shoot down Stacy and at least verbally supports her for getting a job? Like, he knows he's beat. There's fires in his house, literally putting out fires in his house because he's stretched too thin. Is this growth maybe for Jack here in a real concrete way?
I absolutely 100% felt growth on his part when he tossed the yellow legal pad over to Ace. Wow. I mean, he's literally giving him, you know, the pen in his hand. That's amazing. It was actually a step backwards for me when he started with this faith talk. Hiding bad decisions behind the concept of faith makes me angry. The idea that you shouldn't ask any questions because you should have faith. Oh, that's a hard fuck you. Going forward in a future with someone else, you should be able to have conversations that don't get squashed by, well, if you had more faith, then we could just move on. Oh, no. I am all about the joke of, like, God saying, when the man standing in, you know, dying, saying, why didn't you come help me? And he does the whole, I sent you the helicopter, I sent you the boat, I sent you, you know, all that. It's like, no. I mean, we're going to talk faith in people, but faith in a bigger faith. No, God helps those who help themselves, and do not do this.
Have faith in me. And again, with this idea of have faith in the DWL and money is coming in, Jack, I mean, even if you believe that line, you know, Stacy is giving you concrete money concerns that you can't answer other than faith. And by the way, why should she have faith? Because we go from there to the pitch meeting and it doesn't go well. I mean, we have to talk about Eddie Earle and this whole conversation and this pitch for Eddie Earle and his businesses expanding their financial support in advertising dollars in the DWL.
Do you recognize old Eddie Earle from Mad Men? He makes me laugh every time I see him because he's Freddy and he's like such a wimpy dude in Mad Men.
Yeah, I recognized him from somewhere. I did not place him, though, in Mad Men.
That's where he's from. And so for me, I have a hard time like getting past him. But you know what? He made sound business decisions and he didn't say shit about faith. Like, mm-mm, this is not about faith.
Let's listen to how Eddie shuts this pitch meeting down.
I've been in since the get-go. I'm giving you as much as I'm comfortable. Any more just wouldn't be a wise investment.
What? Tell us. Why not, Eddie?
Well, supporting the DWL is good for my pawn shop, because we're here in Duffy, a place where people pawn things they cherish because their backs are up against the wall. We don't live in a taking chances kind of world.
Are you writing down what he said?
For his book.
Now, my secondhand car business, that's where I could use the growth, but the DWL doesn't help me there because y'all ain't got the reach. I told your father, your biggest problem is in the name. Duffy Wrestling League? Every show's a house show. anybody that gives a crap lives in the area.
Well, that's my point, Eddie. We need someone local to get behind us, and then we can expand our fan base. There's got to be something we can do here to show you what we
Jack,
mean.
Jack, I invest in the DWL because you provide a captive audience that's emotionally invested in make-believe. An audience made up of folks who, despite their circumstances, believe the dreams are going to come true and their luck can change. But unless Duffy wins a bid to be the next Amazon outpost, or Hurricane lops off half of Georgia, makes Duffy oceanfront, the dreams aren't coming true and luck ain't turning. And the population of Duffy ain't expanding. Neither is the DWL. Sorry.
I mean, Eddie Earl is giving some hard fucking truth here that Jack does not want to hear.
But was very fair. I mean, that's what we were talking about. Like, when we were like, but the location hasn't changed and the makeup of this town hasn't changed. The money that's here in this town isn't changing. You know, that's where you've got to like get on board with a business model that just embraces who you can be at this level, you know, be the best you can be at this level.
You couple that together because he has his fit and he storms out and Willie calms him down in the parking lot and she says, you want to show reach? Well, bring in Wild Bill. The guy's got reach. I mean, the Eddie Earl said, do X and I'll invest with you more. You know, show me you have reach. And Jack shuts down the one concrete way that they can get reach based on where they are now. So Jack has the right ideas, but business is business and personal is personal. And in the same way, he's preaching to Ace about how Ace has to have, you know, himself, the person, and himself, the character. Jack has to have his personal bullshit, but he has to be able to put that aside for business reasons. I have to deal with people I fucking loathe every day, but I have to do it because of my business, not because of my personal feelings towards them. That's what crying in your beer is for at nighttime. Mm-hmm. You know, when I'm on the phone or sending emails, you gotta, business is business, and you gotta deal with Wild Bill because he can get you the Eddie Earl dollars. He can get you the used car dollars, not just the pawn shop dollars.
That's funny.
I mean, I don't want to wait for Georgia to get hit by a hurricane and make Duffy waterfront property. That was a very funny line that Eddie Earl said.
A very funny line.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like Eddie Earl. He's a son of a bitch. He's a snake in the grass, but he's making good. He's making good business decisions. He's not acting personally here.
I think he understands where they are in the world. You know, the pawn shop is a good business because of the economic state of the town.
Right.
You know, like
the pawn shop is a metaphor for Duffy. Yeah.
And he really gets it. He understands where these people are and what they can offer. And so there's limits. And I think that, you know, you asked me a long time ago when we were doing a couple of these earlier episodes, when you were like, how long do you let someone hold on to a dream? You know, how long do you allow them to just be like, the sky's the limit, honey, like that kind of thing. I think that it's fair, especially when it comes to money spending. And this is like the moment here. To be able to start saying we have to set limits. We can set goals, but we also have to set limits. Like we can go to this point and then we have to turn this amount of profit before anyone's willing to go to this next point. And it's okay to want to be the biggest guy on the hill, but we got to just be a little bit bigger before we can ever get there, you know? So that I think back to that question that you asked. Because, you know, people think, you know, is Eddie Earl really shitting on him? Or is he saying, focus on what you can accomplish and stop feeling like you need to put your eyes so far down the road?
And I think it's also important. It kind of rewrites last week's episode where we meet Eddie Earl. You know, he's upset about his Bible quote being missing from the banner. And it's clear now after watching this episode and watching business, you know, really about Eddie Earl and his business setting, the Bible verse is what the customers that go to his pawn shop are looking for when they're looking at an Eddie Earl banner. He knows that for the people who are in Duffy, who are going to be hawking their precious goods for money, they want a good revelation quote on that banner. It's piety for good business sake, not because he's actually as a zealot religious high roller. He's just making good business decisions.
Have you actually run into scenarios where just because someone is religious, and even, you know, you can even use the word zealot or whatever, that doesn't in any way correlate to them being blindly generous with something, with their money or their time or anything like that. Like, I think it would be remiss for us to kind of like be like, well, if he was really a good Christian, then he would just open his pockets and give everything to a terrible idea that's never going to grow. That's not, I mean, why would those two things go hand in hand? So that's where I look at Jack. And again, I shake my head and say, stop hiding behind faith when you really just have a shit idea and you're trying to use that as a big shield. Like, well, if you had faith in me, then you'd allow this to go forward. Mm-mm, stop it. Like, there has to be some good sense behind it. Like, stop hiding behind that.
Right. Exactly. You know, in the same way that God understood that Papa Spade wasn't Judas, God is also not making business loans to the DWL just because they should have faith in Jack.
Yeah, and I don't think that that's how faith works. I think that's such
an abuse
gross,
of the word. Yeah,
it is. It's such an exploitation of the word, and it's right. just to pull on your heartstrings and make you feel like you're betraying them.
Right. It's where religion becomes manipulative instead mm-hmm. of just a source of comfort.
But here's Jack, who's not even the religious man in the room, who is using it, and you're like, you're being terrible. You right. know?
He's doing this snake oil salesman kind of thing. Like, if you just believe hard enough, it's all going to work. Well, Jack, that's not a business plan. Like, I've represented a lot of
you
businesses.
You cannot believe money into existence.
Right. I've represented a lot of businesses. I've helped make a lot of business plans. I've been at pitch meetings with banks for big, big loans. Never has anyone ever said to a loan officer, have faith in me. I'm going to be able to repay it. It's coming.
Or tried to shame the bank when the bank wanted their money back or something. They'd be like, shame on you for not having faith. The bank's like, shut up. Right. Like,
this is your opening.
Real.
This is if this is your opening response, that does not bode well for anyone. If you're opening.
Hey, you know what? Let's talk about this promo, because I have to ask you, you were talking about snake oil salesmen and all that. I want to go to that promo portion, because I actually thought this was a good idea. It came from Ace, but I think it came together. What did you think?
I think it was great. I think it was a nod. I think the whole thing with them in the couch watching the old Halloween promo between Wild Bill and Tom Spade, and then watching the quote unquote cinematic promo that Ace wants to put forth, that like the Florida dystopian, you know, Florida wrestling dystopia has been doing. Both of these still exist in wrestling. You definitely get the cheesy in-ring guy staring at camera one, like a stationary camera, and be like, you insulted my family's honor and I'm going to whip your ass at the main event next week kind of thing. That promo definitely happens. But you also totally get this real world kayfabe based promo cut, like you see here, where, you know, the good guy Bobby Pinn, man of the people, is just trying to get his red slushy, and, you know, the big bad villain comes out and starts whipping his ass. That whole thing, a Crystal on the ATV on the four wheeler running him down. I loved it. Wrestling,
that was so fun.
Fist fighting through the
slushy machine splash on his face.
Slushy. I mean, puking up cat from her cat gizzard. Wrestling, fist fighting in the way
the
in
car
the
car wash.
Yeah,
I loved
in the
that.
Bed of the truck, fist fighting through the car wash was hysterical. It
was fun.
It was violent. It was athletic, and it was funny. That's all you need. That's what you need for wrestling. Violent, funny, and athletic. Because these guys are doing some impressive things. When Ace does from the ground kip up into the way back of the truck, have you ever jumped from the ground into the bed of a truck over
no,
the
sir,
side?
I don't do that.
No, I can't do that. I need a step stool, and I need the back to be down. Like, you know.
The lift gate.
I need the lift gate down, and I need a step stool. I need to get up on the fender. I need to grunt a little bit because I'm old, and then I can get to the way back. I'm not jumping from the fucking ground. Are you
I'm
kidding me?
I'm usually going to say, like, give me a hand. Who's ever still in there?
Yeah. Well, men don't do that. We grunt and groan in private.
We could all help each other out. But I thought it was great. I thought it was fresh, and it felt young, you know, in a way that didn't feel like that old beaten down, you know, billboard in the town. It felt like fresh and young and energetic.
It felt
and
like
that's
Ace.
Totally what they needed. Yeah.
It felt like the best parts of Ace.
Well, and not just Ace, though. I would say it felt like all of them. It felt like Apocalypse. It felt like Rooster. Like, it felt like Crystal. It felt like we're a young, wild group who want to put on a great show for you and like watch how we can do so many different things.
We're scrappy. Really cool. We're scrappy. We're youthful. We're not your father's DWL. And that's why, I mean, I'm saying it felt like Ace in the best parts of Ace, but it felt like Ace, Bobby, and Crystal being the young newcomers to this.
Yeah.
Whereas Willie, who's shooting, and Jack and Rooster and Apocalypse too, who don't have a major part, like they're like the old guard kind of thing. So you've got this new blood idea. What I really liked about the promo, I mean, I liked the promo itself, was I liked how happy everyone was. This is
me
the,
too.
This is the first time all of these people have smiled, especially all together.
I was worried that when Jack was going to come up behind, that he was going to be like, no, 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 that looked like crap or something, you know? I was so glad for no criticism, to be like, yes, that was awesome.
Even about the cat gizzard, smiling. Right.
Yeah, and the fact the cat gizzard, and then being like, yeah, but it works, just do it.
Right.
That was what a boost to the morale of the entire group.
You know, we haven't talked about the fact that this is episode 4, and so this is the halfway point of the season. I think it was super important to see the DWL, the entirety of the DWL, having a good bonding moment without angst, without chips on shoulders, without ego, literally all of them coming together, doing a thing that is going to improve all of their lots. I think that was super important for it to be at the end of episode 4 as you go into the midway, because when we start episode 5 next week, that's the back end of the season. And so it's important that you have this good moment and you show them all bonded together.
But there's potential poop in the soup.
Poop in the soup in the form of Bobby Pin.
Bobby Pin plus Crystal equals hearts and ice cream.
I don't want to spend too much time on Crystal and Bobby working on the character of who Bobby Pin is.
Because at the end of the day, he just becomes the everyman, which is what he started with. But I enjoyed the journey, but there's not that much to talk about.
No, but I think what we do have to talk about is Crystal is awfully smiley at Bobby. She gets to see him really in his element. And listen, Bobby is a cute, joyful puppy who is just in love with the world and is so excited to be there. He is pure joy personified. And
how refreshing is it to be around someone who's just happy to be there? I mean, sometimes that's all you have to do to be the best person at a get together or the best person wherever you are. It's just be happy to be alive and be there. And he most certainly is.
Right. And he never makes a move on her. He clearly seems to have feelings for her to some extent. But I'll give him credit. You can look into it that way for sure. But it's never overtly sexual or romantic anyway. He really makes it clear, first and foremost, he respects her, thinks she's a badass, respects her talent. And that's what I mean. I think it was an interesting conversation about how she's trying to tell him, don't tell Jack or anyone else, I'm the one who's helping you with your gimmick. That's not going to serve you. This idea that she really needs to keep a low profile. He rejects that. So I like the fact that it was approached non-romantically. It was very platonic, but TV being what it is, and the way Ace watches the two of them, you know, mess around on the trampoline and have fun playing with each other. Is there a romantic angle here? Is Crystal the kind of person who would be attracted to a happy Bobby Pin? Or is she the kind of person who is always going to go for the bad boy, the ace, the one who spanks her asses, fucks her doggy style, and says mean things to her?
Here's the thing. I could see a reversal of roles here. So do I think that she could be the woman behind the man of a Bobby Pin situation? No, I don't. But could Bobby Pin be the man behind the woman with Crystal wrestling and him being her secondary partner, like her, not necessarily valet, but like having like a little step down from her sometimes? Yeah, I think that he actually doesn't always have to have the spotlight. And when you tip that card that I don't always have to have the spotlight, I'm okay with you getting credit and you being the one. I think that that gives a huge, like, wide berth for Crystal to be able to grow and change. Now, I don't know if he's going to be interesting enough and have enough depth for Crystal, but I think that, you know, she might be, he could be her Ted at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe he represents a Ted in her life because, you know, she's looking at him and she's giving him all sorts of smiles. And, you know, I think in a lot of TV shows, you would see like attraction grow there when he like is signing the autographs for the kids and then they take the selfie and she's just kind of watching and being very smiley. That's the part in a lot of shows where it would be like, and at that moment, Crystal fell in love with Bobby. But there's something about her, and I think Kelly Berglund does a great job here. It doesn't quite reach her eyes or her heart. She's not being sexually attracted to him here. I think she's just watching him as a good guy and is enjoying this idea of someone just without baggage, without angst, just being a good guy. And I'm curious how people see that.
She does marvel at the good guy nature of it all.
And I think it's so rare in her life.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's the look I see in her eye, marveling at how naive and innocent and malleable and just easygoing he is. I mean, at the end of the scene when Ace has clearly keyed Bobby's car, right, and Bobby says, well, it kind of looks like racing stripes. Yeah. Who didn't go, oh my goodness, like you are just like the biggest optimist I have ever seen in my life. I mean, never ever thinking who would do this to me, you know, like, oh, like just having such a lightness about him. But I don't know if that gets to last, you know. I think that
gets you in the friend zone. I don't think that gets you the girl in the end of the day. I really don't. But that being said, listen, if you meet a Bobby in your life, if you can get a Bobby pin in your life, you should take it, because you're gonna have some more joyful moments than you would have without a Bobby pin in your life, I think.
Smiling and jumping on a trampoline is like one of the most fun, carefree moments you can have. I'm glad that even when she said, I don't think we should be out in public and being seen together because of the Ace and valet and all that stuff, I love that he just said, well, I guess we have to hang out here.
And she doesn't shoot him down, right? And she,
right. Like, he's just going to just keep being like, no problem. Nothing's a problem. Everything's okay.
A little fun set decorating note, because, you know, people listening may not know, Caroline co-hosts the podcast From Hollywood to Your Home, decorating a set From Hollywood to Your Home with Beth Kushnick. They're in their trailer when Bobby and Crystal are having their first conversation. Over Bobby's left shoulder on the shelf is a miniature bowling pin. And I thought that was a fun little set decorating, because his name is Bobby Pin in the show.
It is funny.
And there was one other in the background thing that I wanted to point out. This is not about Bobby. In the opening scene, when Wild Bill is in the corporate offices, over the corporate lady's shoulder, way back on the wall, there's a poster for a guy named David Ali. So I was like, that's a very specific kind of thing to put there. So I went and I looked. David Ali is actually a real professional wrestler. He has been on every single indie circuit. It doesn't look like he's ever been with a major promotion, but the guy's been around for a long time. He has wrestled all of the indie circuits, and he wrestles under the name Raz Ali. Fun little, you know, head nod to a real wrestler there in the background at the New York offices of the unnamed wrestling promotion.
I love that.
I think the last question before we end today is, what is the ramification of Ace seeing Bobby and Crystal together? Because obviously he seems to think it's romantic. The immediate ramification is that he fucks Trisha in his bedroom while he stares at himself in the mirror.
Yeah, that's a whole mood, huh?
That's a whole mood. Lord. I mean, when she goes, oh my God, when she says, when she turns
that's
around.
That's sad. Want to go again?
Well, that, but when she turns around and he spanks her and she says, oh, I forgot you were the bad guy now. I mean, it's kind of a hot sex scene, but also like bad sex partner. This is not going to give you the emotional support you want, Ace.
I think he was looking for emotional support that evening.
Well, he was later on, though, when they were post-coital and he's reliving his dad's words to him.
Yeah, it wasn't happening.
No. But what's your prediction here on the ramifications?
He's going to take it out on Bobby, I think, you know, and I think it's also going to cause friction between Crystal and Willie. I think she's going to get in her face about what she can and can't do with the different wrestlers and that type of thing, because Willie's got a history hanging out with the wrestlers, now we know. So I think there's going to be a lot going on with that. And I 100% think Ace is going to take this out on Bobby. He's probably going to do something to hurt him, which would super suck, man.
I think that makes a lot of sense and seems very much in Ace's wheelhouse because he'll be able to blame it on being, quote unquote, a heel now.
This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Thank you for listening to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the Duffy Wrestling Dirt Sheet at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, if you could leave us a 5-star rating, that would be fantastic so that we don't have to talk about how you're going to burn in hell for all eternity. Because, you know, we like you and we don't want you to burn in hell for all eternity.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.